On this edition of Random Assignment, learn why the school choice movement has never had a week like we have just had, with lockdowns leading to the unlocking of school choice across the fruited plain. Also, hear Corey once again correct yet another error from a major newspaper about district school spending trends. And why would someone say that teachers' union policies have contributed to systemic racism? Do not be an April Fool. Stay tuned for this edition of Random Assignment. Ground control to Major Tom. It's a
taking off
space shuttle. Of course, a space shuttle is old technology now. We should have found, we should have found the Tesla version.
Yeah, Elon Musk should have made it. This one looks kind of dorky, but oh well, you get the point.
the title being, and we're kind of making fun of it. The title being, has school choice reached escape velocity? Now, in that picture, it looks like the shuttle is already clearly in Earth orbit, well past escape velocity. Anyway, Corey, what did you mean by when you were inspired by the title?
I don't know. Yeah, it seems pretty crazy that this past year, especially this past week, we've seen a lot of movement. Can you hear that in the background?
I did.
There's a bell going off. What the heck? But in the past week, there's been a ton of positive news when it comes to school choice, or what I call funding students instead of systems, in so many states. And some of them were, one of them at least in particular, which we'll talk about, was pretty close, right down to the wire. And it will be the second most expansive education savings account program in the nation. That's in Kentucky. You said there was 11 states that you could rattle off the top of your head that there's movement.
I got to tell you guys. Now, this is more about headlines, in fairness, than it is actual legislative victories. So sometimes, but I'm just responding to major headlines. So I've counted up, and maybe, Corey, you'll find I missed some. 11 states with news. I'm going to give these in alphabetical order simply because I couldn't think of any other order to give them in. But I want you to, as everybody listens to what I'm about to list, please check the dates of these news stories. Keep track, okay? Let's start. March 24th, Florida. That's in Florida, where the House bill would dramatically expand school choice in Florida. This is combining some of their school choice programs. March 29th, Associated Press story, Georgia lawmakers pass special education voucher expansion. From March 25th in Iowa, Iowa House approves charter school expansion. From March 27th in Indiana, lawmakers remain resolute on push for big expansion of private school choice program. March 30th in Kansas House tentatively approves major expansion of school choice policies. March 29th, Kentucky, House and Senate override the veto of a man Corey calls the poster child for school choice hypocrisy, Governor Alan Beshear. Andy Beshear. March 25th, Missouri, school choice proposal wins approval in the House. It's a intra-district school choice bill. March 26th, Montana House advances big increase in tax credit for private school choice program. March 26th in Oklahoma, State Board of Education approves resolution to equalize funding for all charter schools and public schools. Equalize charter school funding in Oklahoma. March 29th, this was just Monday, West Virginia governor approves what advocates say is the nation's broadest school choice program. Ladies and gentlemen, I have just told you 11 state headlines in 8 days that are all major stories about school choice expansions. I have been in this space about 10 years. There has never been a week like this. There has never been one week like this. So, Corey, what do you make of it all?
Well, I think the Wall Street Journal editorial board had it right, that the union shutdowns have increased support across the country for more educational options. So they went over in this article a bunch of the states that you talked about. Of course, they hit on West Virginia, which will be the biggest education savings account program in the country. And it has already been signed into law by Governor Jim Justice, as you said, and it is the most expansive school choice proposal in any state this year, and West Virginia got it done. And what's interesting about the West Virginia story is that they went from a 0 to 100 real quick. In 2019, they passed a charter school law, but even today, they still do not have any charter schools on the ground in West Virginia. They didn't have any private school choice mechanisms that fund students directly either. So they went from having essentially nothing in terms of educational freedom all the way to the top by passing this expansive education savings account program in West Virginia. It was.
Let me just add a couple of things to that. Mm-hmm. One is looming large in the West Virginia landscape with this giant Red for Ed strike where thousands of teachers all just said, you know, kind of hell no, we won't go, i.e. to our jobs. And that seemed like, what was that, a year ago, year and a half ago? Not that long ago.
Yep.
Seemed like you had a state leaning hard in the one-size-fits-all public school direction. And to suddenly see this, it is stunning. Also, too, this it's really eligibility, right? So usually private school choice programs are what we call means tested. They're for low income or low to medium income or sometimes into the middle class. In West Virginia, they said now it's going to only be $4,600 per student, or at least for maybe that's not including special needs, but I'm not sure. But I think $4,600 is the base number for what parents would get if they chose private school. So it's not going to be as much as the regular district schools would be spending in West Virginia. But that said, anyone's eligible. They're not saying you have to be low income. They're not saying you have to be, you know, maybe medium income. They're just saying, look, anybody wants to exit the public schools, you get less, but you get this amount and you are eligible.
Yep. And it essentially proves the some people will make the argument that you have to start small in order to get school choice. You have to start with a little tiny program and then maybe you can. And there's some legitimacy to that argument. But at the same time, if you start small, you may not get anything at all because of what happens with negotiations. If you start big, maybe you dwindle it down just a little bit and then you still get something pretty big. And then too, the teachers unions will come after you just as hard, whether it's a very tiny program only for special needs or only for very, very low income populations, or whether it's available to everybody. The teachers union is going to act like the sky is falling no matter what. So you might as well go big. And this is what West Virginia did. They didn't have any school choice programs. And then now they have this huge program that's, I think, at least 93% of the school age population is eligible in the first year, and it ratchets up higher after that. The only groups that are not included in the first year are people who are currently homeschooling and currently paying for private school tuition and fees out of pocket. They have a requirement in the law that you have to be in a public school for at least like 40 to 50 days, which is a lot lower than the requirement in other states, which is around 100 days. And so it's pretty expansive in that way, that you could theoretically go into the public school system for a couple of months and then switch back and be eligible. I don't think that should be a requirement because it causes a lot of problems between switching back and forth. And the people who were giving the most pushback to this program, although they liked it, the most complaints were coming from those two groups, the homeschoolers and the people who had already paid for private school tuition and fees out of pocket. They wanted to be included as well. So they, I believe, include an amendment to where in a few years they will phase it to where they will be included in the long run as well.
Yeah, so that's an important correction. I was talking about how there's no more income eligibility limitations. There were still those limitations regarding what you said. And Florida actually is now considering doing something too along those lines. But anyway, go ahead. I cut you off. What are you going to say?
Well, no. So that's West Virginia. You know, it's an ESA. The money follows the child, just like we argue for. You could use it for tutoring, textbooks, private school tuition and fees, micro schools, pandemic pods, special needs therapy, any government approved education expense. And you had the number, right? It's about $4,600 per student per year. I think the more interesting story, although it's not the biggest school choice proposal that it was passed in the past week, it's still a big one. I think the more interesting story is Kentucky. Kentucky, a lot of people didn't know what was going to happen with Kentucky. They similarly, I believe, do not have any charter schools on the ground, even though they technically do have a charter school law that passed a couple of years ago, similar to West Virginia, did not have any private school choice programs. So it is similar to West Virginia in a way where they've gone from zero to a lot. And their program will be the second most expansive in the nation. But there was a lot of nonsense going on over the past week where the House and Senate passed the bill and it would be available to anyone living in a county, regardless of income. Or actually, it's 175% of the free or reduced lunch price program, I believe. And it's you have to be in a county of 90,000 people or larger, which is a large segment of the population in Kentucky. School choice proponents wanted it to be everybody. I get it, but you got to get your foot in the door in some places, and perhaps it'll be universal in the near future. But the governor vetoed the bill. But in Kentucky, to override a veto, you only need a constitutional majority, which is different from a simple majority. You have to have a majority of people in the entire legislature, in the House and the Senate separately, not just 51% of the vote. It's 51% of each chamber. So in the House, they needed 51 votes exactly. And just a couple of nights ago, Monday night, the House voted 51 votes exactly to 42, but they needed the 51 to get that override. And in the Senate, they needed 20 votes. They got 23 votes, I want to say, and they successfully overrode the governor's veto. But it's more interesting than that, in that Governor Andy Beshear is one of the biggest school choice hypocrites in the nation, where he sent his own kids to private school. This came out into public knowledge in 2019 in the governor's race. And when questioned about it, he admitted it. But then he said, well, his first response to the reporter was just, because they asked, you know, don't you think this is a little hypocritical? He said, I'm a public school graduate. Instead of responding to the actual question, he shifted to, I'm a proud, and he said during his press conference when he was vetoing House Bill 563, you know, defend the public, we got to protect the public school system, you know, we got to value public education. He made this whole spiel about how he's a proud product of public schools and how he's a proud graduate of Kentucky public schools. And I looked into it and you could not see anywhere where he went before high school until I found in a newspaper article that was behind a paywall from April 1985, a snippet of something saying that it was about his father, who was in office at the time, saying that the police or something would give security rides to his son, Andy Beshear, the current governor, to their private school. Didn't have a name. And so that was the one piece of information on the internet, period, showing that he had also attended private school. But he never once revealed that.
Product of public schools, to say, to pretend as if he had only been to public schools, when in fact he had been to both public and private schools. And you brought that out.
And so I brought that into light. It was revealed during testimony on the day of the override, where they brought it up that he went to private school too. And right before that testimony, a couple of hours before it actually that day, after I shared this snippet showing that he went to private school online, an anonymous account who didn't want their name shared publicly on Twitter that person had attended the same private school with Andy Beshear and that they were in a different grade, but that they attended the school together. And I said, oh, that's interesting. And they actually dug up the yearbook out of their garage or wherever it was in their vicinity. And they sent me the pictures of the yearbook of the specific school. And it was Capital Day School in the Capitol, Frankfort, Kentucky. And they sent the cover of the yearbook, the picture, the whole page, the zoom in of Andy Beshear's class photo.
Was that his first grade?
It was in 1987.
Someone on Twitter pushed back and said, oh, he only went to first grade. So that's dispute. Was it only first grade?
The year in which there was the article that I found was 1985. So we know he was in a private school in 1985. The yearbook that the person sent me was a 1987 yearbook. So we know he went for more than 1 year. And the only evidence we have of primary education was that he was in a private school.
And so he never responded to this? He was never peppered with questions by the local media?
No, No, and during, right before the override vote, one of the Republican representatives, I want to say, it was the House override. His first name was Jerry. You can go look it up. He pointed out, Bashir attended Capitol Day School. He must have got the information leaked through the Twitter web somewhere.
I hope you helped take some of the wind out of the sails of the anti-choice crowd and helped foster that veto override. I wanted to say two quick things about Kentucky because there's a lot of states to talk about. But one is that, you know, you could kind of dismiss it and say, there he is.
Here's his quick photo.
Sweet little Andy there. Yeah. You can dismiss it and say, well, the Kentucky program is only a $25 million program for an entire, might be a lot for you and me, but for a whole state, maybe $25 million is not that big a deal. But what I wanted to point out is that all of the drama, which is not just the fact that it came down to a veto and then a veto override and then the veto override by exactly one vote that was needed, all that drama fostered all kinds of media coverage, local media coverage that we haven't seen. All these other 11 stories I said in the last 8 days have not gotten the coverage that Kentucky got because of that drama. And so I have this philosophy that whenever you talk about school choice, we win. Like if you go to your local school board meeting and talk about it, or a city council, a school board member talks about choice on the council, and maybe they're not even that well-versed in the subject, and they get defeated in the debate by other people who say you're draining money from public schools. Just the more everybody talks about it, it doesn't even matter if it's informed or not informed, we tend to move the ball forward. And so that's what I'm seeing with a lot of this coverage. And I pulled out, this is an example of coverage from both sides that came out of Kentucky about the veto override.
The school choice bill is controversial. Today I talked to parents on both sides, but one thing was the same. They all want what's best for their kids.
I support it 100%.
Well, I'm not in favor of that.
Last night, the House voted 51-42 in favor of the override, meaning House Bill 563 goes into law. The bill creates tax breaks and scholarships for students to go to private schools and allows families to move their children from one district to another.
I think it gives long overdue choice back to parents and back to students.
But critics say lawmakers should invest in public education first.
If we were really concerned about fairness and equity for kids who go to schools that are underperforming, why isn't there just simply the political will to adequately fund those schools?
The bill will top off $25 million in tax breaks to send kids to private schools, something JCPS parent Kendall Nash argues could be spent in other ways.
And I think we need to be shoring up public schools with this $25 million instead of allowing public dollars to then be put into private schools.
But JCPS parent Steve Ullum doesn't agree. He is planning on moving his child out of JCPS.
If their objection is the money, then I think the focus is in the wrong spot. I think the focus needs to be on the student and not the money.
Many, along with the governor, argued this would divert tax dollars badly needed by our public schools, saying one district's gain is another district's loss.
To me, it strikes me as almost like a weird sort of reverse Robin Hood, right, where you take away from people who don't have much and then you give to people who already have everything. I'm not convinced that the motivation is pure.
Gay Alderman, co-founder of the grassroots organization Dear JCPS, agrees that parents should have the choice to switch districts. But she says this is not the way it should be done.
They don't need state laws to make that possible. The problem with the state laws is that it now creates a one-size-fits-all forced solution that may benefit some while harming others.
Governor Bashir said he would consider challenging the bill, calling it unconstitutional. For WHAS 11 News, I'm Elle Smith.
She really called school choice one size fits all? Are you kidding me?
Well, the part I'm reacting to was when they say it's like reverse Robin Hood to take away from the people who don't have. And I'm like, wait a minute. So only the people who choose to be in the program are choosing to be in the program. How are you taking away from somebody by offering them another option that they don't have right now? How does that take? Offer me options, and if I say no, how have you taken away from me? You know, anyway.
Yeah, you gotta love it.
But my point is, it doesn't matter. Run all these stories. All these stories have a cumulative effect. You know, school choice just keeps marching forward.
That's
I know
right.
That we're a small percentage of the total enrollment of the United States student population. I understand that. Charter schools, I think, what 6%, I think, of the student enrollment. Private school choice programs, about 1%, but total private schools, more like 10%, I think. Those are rough numbers. We're still, a great majority are in traditional district schools. But the numbers of school choice programs and charter school programs never goes down. It just goes up and up, even though it is a small base.
I wanted to share a clip of Bashir 2 years ago saying, "I'm a proud public school graduate," when he was pressed about, hey, and you'll hear the reporter too saying, like, don't you think that's kind of hypocritical? I'm trying to find it really quickly.
My advice for Corey is don't visit Kentucky anytime soon until at least there's a new governor. If Corey finds his way into Lexington or Louisville or something, I would like keep looking over your shoulder.
Yeah, so you let me know if you can't hear this.
But in your most precious investment, your own children, they go to private school. Why don't they go to public school? And is that kind of is that hypocritical that your children go to private school?
I'm a public school graduate. I believe in public schools, and my kids will be going to a public middle school.
I'm a public school
graduate. It's a typical politician's thing. Yeah, I'm a public school graduate.
Yeah.
Graduated. Yeah, right.
Well, and then here's another one from the day he vetoed the bill.
Let's not forget, he's a public school graduate, but he chooses to send his own kids to private school.
Can you hear this one? No. I bet.
Can't see public education that way.
No?
I went to Kentucky's public schools, and people that sat next to me are now Democrats or Republicans, independents. Most of them, I don't know what party they're in, but public education prepared all of us for our...
Yeah, we're a product
but not
of
my
school.
Kids. Yeah. Public education prepared all of us, but not my kids. No way. They're not going to public school. I went there. I know
I think
there.
I think he said that he switched his kids into public schools. I haven't kept up with that, but I know in 2019 they were not in public schools. But
Maybe.
But the thing is, I mean, it doesn't matter if they were in public for 1 year or 2 years or private for 1 year or 2 years. You had the choice of public versus private in particular years, and it looks like, if anything, he only switched after there was a big backlash of accusations of hypocrisy. So,
yeah. Let me mention something just quickly about the Georgia plan. Georgia has had a special needs voucher for a long time, I think 13 years. They just expanded eligibility by saying instead of just the kids with IEPs, they're going to add kids with what's called 504 plans. Those are the kids who are not behind academically necessarily, but they may have other needs that schools need to address. So you don't need an individualized education plan if you're not academically behind, but you may need other kinds of accommodation. Well, they added this. Basically, in Georgia, there are about 200,000 kids, according to Associated Press, with IEPs, but another 58,000 have these 504 plans. So it's something like a 29% increase in the eligibility of this voucher in Georgia. And there was an interesting and kind of funny rabbit hole. Kind of thing that came up about it. The full Senate had a proposal. They would have allowed the kids with a 504 plan or a diagnosis of a disability to qualify, not necessarily from the public schools. Okay. Now that ended up failing. They're now back on the House version, but that raised concerns. I found this amusing that some parents might obtain bogus disability diagnoses to access the funds, because in the Senate plan that died, the Senate plan would have said you can get a disability diagnosis from the outside, and that would let you be eligible for the voucher. Well, this was a $6,700 voucher. I checked the Census Bureau in 2019 said that Georgia, on average, spent over $10,205 per student. So this voucher is $6,700. What they're saying is they're afraid that parents would create bogus disability documents so that they could get less money spent on their education of their kid. Their fear is that actually we really know a lot of parents might lie so they can get less money. It's this tacit admission of how much more the dollar goes in the private school sector, isn't it? Like, when they're worried that parents may lie to get less money, and that's literally what they express their concern to be, and that's why now that's the House bill requires the public school to also admit this 504 eligibility.
Well, and can't we make the same argument about the public schools have a financial incentive to classify kids of having a special need or disability? Why does it only go one way? Why can we only apply it to one sector and not the other? And can't you similarly make the argument that if that were to set were the setup or if with any private school choice program with for children with special needs, that public schools might have an incentive not to classify kids as having a special need because then they'd be able to leave the system?
It's also long been argued. There's this irony where they will criticize charter schools that have a lower percentage of special needs kids enrolled as being this is evidence of cherry picking. And yet the charters are often trying to get the kids up to grade level to get them off the special needs list. Yeah. That charters are consider it the goal to have a smaller special needs population in many charter schools I've been to. And what you find is that once they do that, they're criticized for it. It's the opposite oftentimes. And we've interviewed many parents that have said this. It's oftentimes, as you point out, the opposite in district schools where they'd actually prefer the kid to stay in special needs throughout their entire educational career, many of these schools, because it gets them more money.
Well, and if you look at the latest experimental study on this from Boston Charter Schools, they found that kids winning the lottery, causal study, random assignment, were a lot less likely, a charter school lottery were a lot less likely to retain their special needs classification. And we can tell it's caused by them going into the charter school sector because of the random assignment mechanism. And that's published at Education Next, a gold standard evaluation that just goes to show you that you can have, you know, let's say 4% of kids having a special need in the charter school sector and then 8% having a special need in the TPS, but the kids being identical as far as their disabilities if the classification rates differ.
There was also, I think it was Oregon was the state that passed a cap on percentage saying you can't go beyond 13% special needs classification. And the next thing you know, all these districts suddenly had exactly 13% special needs classification. This is such a conflict of interest. It's this huge glaring issue that rarely gets talked about. I don't know why there's not an outside third party independent organization that is charged with identifying special needs of kids and making this classification to say the same group that gets more money if the answer is yes, gets to decide whether the answer is yes, is to me, it's a stunning conflict of interest. But that's so,
let's talk about what's going on nationally. I just saw this in Politico Morning Report. I think Lindsay Burke from Heritage Foundation actually sent it over to me because I think she saw it first. But the Biden administration is now talking about, okay, so let's rewind a little bit. The federal government spends about $70 billion per year on K-12 education. In addition to that, they've allocated in March 2020, $13 billion through the CARES Act, $54 billion through the second stimulus bill, and then $126 billion through the American Rescue Plan. Now, the Biden administration, which was reported today, is talking about allocating $100 billion more to
facilities,
for facilities and buildings. And this is not supposed to be the responsibility of the federal government. And it's getting just ridiculous. I mean, it's been ridiculous all along, but I mean, look at this. They already allocated almost $200 billion in stimulus funding in the past year, less than a year. And now they're proposing another $100 billion because money grows on trees, right, Bob?
You know, we were kind of joking about it. It's not, I guess, not funny once the, you know, if the day comes that the dollar collapses or something and we have, you know, I know some are predicting a huge economic looming depression from all this printing of money. And, you know, if the world's reserve currency decides to switch to something else, this could be not all that funny. But I mean, it's almost like, well, is there ever too much? If we just get, what if every week there's a new $100 billion given to schools? Would just the advocates of traditional public education just keep applauding every time? We were joking, let's say you just give every state department of education its own dollar printing press where they can just print money in the state department of education. Would that be yay? It's great. Yeah. We get to print billions of dollars whenever we want. This is the best thing ever. You have the feeling that there's this intoxication or something, this sort of disconnection from reality where there's they don't even know how to spend the money already allocated, as you just pointed out. They're throwing more billions into a bucket that's already overflowing that they can't spend.
It's not about the safety. It's not about safely reopening schools, Bob. It's just about employing more people for the future and then making it seem more mainstream to have that amount of money into the system. And then they're just going to ask for that amount of money in the future when the time comes after, because they'll say, we created all these new jobs with this new stimulus funding. You can't make these people lose their jobs. They're just going to use it to create an additional constituency that they're going to use to lobby to the government for more money in the future. Of course, I haven't uncovered any documents suggesting this, but this seems to be like a logical play from the teachers unions if they were to do that in the future.
Let me just make a couple other notes quickly. One is, I thought the Montana story was interesting, even though it's a small population state. You know, this was a state where they had the big Supreme Court case called Espinoza, which it was about this program. It was about a small program, and the maximum credit went to $200,000. It's a huge increase in the, I assume this would be for the worst, most troubled scenarios of special needs where the kids, that's the credit. That's how much they can write off, I guess. $200,000, they can write off their taxes, I guess, state taxes.
Anyway, is this the one from March 19th?
March 26th, Montana House advances big increase in tax credit. Right. So that I misspoke a second ago. But the main point I wanted to get to was the famous quote from the Espinoza decision where John Roberts, the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, says, "A state need not subsidize private education, but once a state decides to do so, it cannot disqualify some private schools solely because they are religious," unquote. The bill also increased the overall limits. It's going to go from 3 million to up to 7.5 million. So it's more than doubling in size. And I thought that was noteworthy because sometimes these programs start really small and you even have a big Supreme Court case and people say, well, who cares about that program? It's so tiny. Next thing you know, they start increasing it and increasing it and increasing it. And you raise the overall cap of the program and it serves a lot more kids.
So I know Montana had two bills. Is this the House Bill 329 for special needs students or is this the other one?
The other one.
The existing program that already
existing.
Program. And then, yeah, they had that weird, you can only donate like $200 or something. So that
$150. Yes.
And now it's how much? 200,000?
200,000.
All right. I didn't even know about this. This is something I didn't know about yet. So in Montana, this program that you're talking about is essentially available to everybody, yet essentially nobody was using it because of that funding flaw where you couldn't pool enough money from so many different sources in order to make scholarships available. So this is actually a huge, and where did it pass?
What makes it not used? It's still only $3 million statewide. And then it's eventually slated to go to $7.5 million statewide. So again, that's kind of like saying where the Kentucky thing was $25 million. You say, mm-hmm. There's still a cap statewide that's pretty onerous. But
yeah, but before they couldn't even get to the cap, right? Because it had like a $200 donation limit, which was ridiculous. So
yeah,
it's not huge in the sense of, you know, everybody's going to get it overnight, but it's a big step forward for Montana. And I hadn't even heard about that yet, but they also have a special needs program that passed their House 6633 on March 19th. And this is an education savings account, not just a tax credit scholarship. House Bill 329 that could be used for, you know, just like any other ESA, private schools, tutoring, instructional materials, any other approved education expenses. So Montana's doing great this year.
Yeah.
So much is going on that one slipped me.
Well, please. The a couple of charter school stories, too, I'm sure more that slipped me, but one is the one in Iowa where it had been that the district was required to authorize charter schools. And now they're kind of saying this, well, it's the Iowa House has approved this expansion where now a charter organization can apply to the State Department of Education to be authorized, not just needing the Burger King to authorize McDonald's from the regular school district. And then you have the one in Oklahoma, which equalizes charter funding. We've never seen anything like that in the United States in the history of the charter school sector. Equalized funding. And to say like the same kid is worth the same amount of money no matter what school is chosen, that is that sounds revolutionary. I mean, what do you think?
Woo-hoo. Yeah, it's how it should be. A lot of places across the U.S., the charter schools get a lot less funding per student, but it doesn't make any sense. If it's about the kid, they should get the same amount of funding wherever they go. That sounds like a step in the right direction. Iowa, that's great that it passed the House. The House, from what I can tell, is the heavier lift in Iowa, so the Senate should be no problem for that charter school bill to allow multiple authorizers. That's a step in the right direction, too. Another state is Kansas. Their full House just passed yesterday, maybe, or maybe it was 2 days ago, an expansion of their existing tax credit scholarship program in the House. It's House Bill 2119. The vote was 65-58 in Kansas. Yeah, there's just so many things going on in the state houses that it's hard to keep track of it all.
Yeah, while I mentioned the other two, a third charter news was the one from Nevada, where they allowed, so these charter schools that don't have enough facilities funding, in some states, many places, the charters aren't even given any facilities funding. They just are given the per student that the regular district schools spend. In other words, the regular district schools already have the buildings there paid for through other parts of state and local budgets. And then some 70 to 75% of that is given to the charter schools. And from that, they're also supposed to pay for their own facilities. Well, in Nevada, they've said that they should give tax credits to people that donate to help charter schools have buildings. So they're saying kind of, why not? This is serves the public interest. So this is a bill anyway. It's been introduced in Nevada. It hasn't passed yet, but it's another completely new idea. I've never heard of that before. Some states are saying, gee, what if this were either tax deductible or tax credit to allow to help a charter with their building?
Yeah, that makes sense. And it'll help that funding inequity between the sectors. We'll see what happens
Nevada. Tax deductions already exist for nonprofit groups that would that could help in that regard. But I guess this would be a tax credit. So that would be the distinction.
Did you see that the Philly Inquirer made the same mistake, or intentional or not, regarding education funding that I forced them to correct about a year ago? They made the same mistake.
Almost
worded in the same way too. So here's my tweet on this. Here's the Pennsylvania K-12 education funding per student over time in real terms. These are in 2019 dollars. It's gone up steadily. 73% real increase since 1990 to 2019. Here's what the Philly Inquirer said in their latest piece from a couple of days ago. State lawmakers have drastically reduced state funding for public schools over the last generation. Generation is typically around 20 to 30 years. That's why I provided data from about 30 years, so you can see the trend. There's no way they could say this to be true. You might say, oh, well, this is state funding. Maybe they're just looking at the state portion of the funding.
Yeah.
No, here's that data in by year. This is total per student. And I also put together, actually had help from Commonwealth Foundation's Mark LeBlond. He knew where to find these data at the Pennsylvania Department of Education website. In real terms, the state share also increased by about 68% since 1990. So there's no way they can say this and make and believe that it's true. They're just repeating the same lie that they said about a year ago, a little over a year ago. They said public education has seen such drastic cuts to funding over the last few decades. It's pretty much the same claim. And they ended up actually changing that. Here's the initial claim, which is funny. Look what they did here in December 2019. Here's the original claim. you know, they've seen drastic cuts to funding over a few decades. Then they said, then they changed it to over the last decade instead of decades, but then that was still wrong. And then they changed it again after I corrected them, saying it's still wrong if you use one decade or three decades. And then they just kept the narrative and changed the sentence to say, despite these increases to funding,
the costs are outpacing, which
they didn't have any evidence for that claim either. But they just kept the same story, kept the narrative, and just that didn't matter what the facts said. They just, but anyway, the main point that I wanted to make was they made the exact same error, and it's either incompetence on the part of the editors that they just didn't see it, or maybe they didn't have time to look at it, or it's they're outright lying at this point because they've been corrected on this before. And I think the last piece, I think both of these pieces were by journalists as well. So they can't just say, oh, it is true that
special needs spending is much higher than it was in a generation ago, that the special needs industry has grown up, as we pointed out before, to some extent too. It has been a self-interested aspect of public education. So that both can be true. That can be true at the same time. Mm-hmm. There are legitimate costs of special needs spent education that are being done that weren't being done, 30 or 40 years ago. So that's true too. But nevertheless,
but that wasn't the claim.
Continue to say what you point out, which is they lie about the spending. And in fact, Neil McCluskey had a chart also just today on his piece about that. It showed the chart over time of cost of inflation adjusted spending in public schools.
Did you see Erica Sanzi's new group?
Tell me.
Erica Sanzi, who is affiliated as a fellow at the Thomas B. Fordham Institute and was at Brightbeam. She's now a director of outreach at this new organization that just launched yesterday, and it's gotten a lot of attention. I think yesterday when I looked at their Twitter at first, they had 500 followers. I think it's probably closer to 5,000 followers now, but their main thing is combating political indoctrination in the classroom. And it's called Parents Defending Education. If you want to go check it out, they also have a Twitter account @DefendingEd. It's now, their following went from 500 yesterday to over 6,000 already. But our pal, Erica Sanzi is over there, and she wrote about why this is so important there. So, and I think it's getting a lot of attention because, look, I mean, part of a lot of the remote learning is a lot of families started to figure out that they didn't like what was going on in the classroom. It's kind of one of the silver linings of the pandemic that families started to become more involved with what's going on in the classroom. And there's been a lot of pushback to what families are seeing. And this is part of that kind of result, I believe. This new group, the Parents Defending Education.
That's great. You know, cameras in the classroom had been a proposal tossed around, and it never got much traction, even though as webcams became increasingly inexpensive and bandwidth became ubiquitous. This COVID lockdown Zoom class type education suddenly created this kind of default cameras in the classroom, which led to the transparency to which you refer, the parents seeing what was being taught, I think, in a lot of cases, and maybe some of these states around the country responding to that.
Parents kind of currently do have cameras in the classroom. I wonder if parents will push to keep that when people return to school buildings. If not, I mean, that is currently what's happening. What is being taught is caught on camera right now. Perhaps there'll be pushes for that in the future, even in in-person schooling, maybe not. I don't know how I feel about that myself. But there are some states, Arizona is one of them, that are introducing bills just for more transparency, where at least they're going to have to, or the proposal is for the public schools to upload all the curriculum and assignments onto the web, just so if parents can see a little more, they won't be able to see exactly how it's being taught, because they won't be there, but they would be able to see exactly what materials were being presented in class. So
yeah.
I think that's another result of this whole past, what's gone on in the past year.
Well, kind of another flip side, I guess you might say, to some of the culture war stuff is a video I came across. Brad Palumbo, who's an opinion editor for Fee Online, was talking to Tony Kennett on Chalkboard Review about Brad's piece that argues that teachers' unions' policies are racist. And his point, as he clearly says, was not to allege the teachers in general are racist. He started out by saying what he's not saying. He goes, I'm not saying teachers in general are racist. I'm not saying teachers' union leadership is racist. He goes, I'm simply saying that there's no doubt that the policies the NEA and the AFT push, if you hold them to the same standard other liberal groups apply when they're defining systemic racism, then there's simply no doubt that those same policies are contributing to systemic racism. And so he clarifies that, and he shows, he says, basically, teachers unions are liberal groups. They donate to almost all Democrats. There's no doubt they're liberal groups. They should be held to the same standards of accountability, the same petard, if you will, that that liberals define, used to the same standards liberals use to define systemic racism.
Well, according to the president of the NAACP, systemic racism is systems and structures that have procedures or processes that disadvantage African Americans. Meanwhile, according to the liberal outlet Vox, systemic racism is a term used to talk about all of the policies and practices entrenched in established institutions that harm certain racial groups and help others. Mm-hmm. I think that is an overly broad definition of racism. I wouldn't use it personally, but I think it's fair to hold liberal groups, and make no mistake, teachers unions are liberal groups. They donate to Democrats, sure, lobby for liberal policies, to liberal standards. And there's simply no way of looking at the school closures that we've seen over the last couple of years and the data we have on them and not saying this hurts poor African-American and minority students the most.
Boom. It's Brad.
How do you argue with that? It's a disparate impact that's probably more documented than anything in the last year on education.
Yep. Yep. There are systemic issues with the public school system. A lot of times people don't want to talk about that. Did you see the recent Sacramento teacher, Sacramento, it was a Sacramento area public school district, and he went on a rant in front of the school board and posted it to social media, and he was bragging about it to his followers about how he was accusing parents of being white supremacists for wanting to reopen schools in person.
Ah, yes, I did see that.
So Fox News actually wrote an article about it. California teacher blames white supremacy for parents demanding schools reopen. I first saw this a couple of days ago, and I just published pretty much without comment his full testimony on my Twitter, and people didn't like it very much because, look, I mean, it's just families wanting to get their children back into school in person. They don't want to see the learning loss. They're seeing the issues with mental health that their children are having to deal with over the past year, and this affects all races. So
yeah.
for this teacher to, you know, try to paint parents essentially as white supremacists for wanting the schools open is just extremely disingenuous. I think that same teacher, it's a high school teacher at a public school in Sacramento, locked their social media accounts. I think they put their Facebook and Twitter to private after this came out.
Yeah, I mean, we're in an era, clearly, where people, I think to some degree it's fostered by social media, where, you know, we're in an age where, you know, clicks equals revenue and rage drives clicks. So, but we're in an era where it seems like you'll just use the most vicious language whenever you can. Anyone who's like disagrees with you about something, you should just try to say they're Hitler, you know, like just and everybody's or everyone's in the Klan or something like that. And you get some of these. It's just ridiculous. It's just absurd. And then yep. There's more and more examples of it. It seems like people aren't too ashamed by it. Usually maybe a little bit, but then someone else is right there to take their place.
Well, and speaking of unintended consequences of the lockdowns, our friends at EdChoice just released a national survey today, and they've been doing a lot of great work on this with the third-party morning consult nationwide nationally representative surveys. They did a survey of teens that just came out. I think they were aged 13 to 17 or somewhere along around that age group. Looking at differences in mental health status, and they found that, and here's the quote, teens learning at least partially online were three times as likely to report declining mental health compared to in-person students. And they also went on to describe their findings saying, quote, teens attending school in person are more positive about their education this year than those partially or completely online. You can find that at the edchoice.org public opinion tracker website.
You know, I also wanted to bring up something just as an aside. I just sent you on Facebook, if you could like, McCory, a tweet by one Randy Weingarten with
she's great at those, isn't she?
With whom our viewers and listeners may be familiar. And so, you know, this was a few days before we had the big story, at least before I saw this story about $100 billion from the federal government for facilities. Wow. Like, so before, just a few days before this big new, just, you know, giant showering of largesse about facilities, another new, fresh $100 billion from facilities from the federal government. Look at this. Oddly enough, Randy tweeted about how the key to opening schools and keeping them open, what is it? It's better airflow. And that's a massive job because the school facilities she's talking about haven't had the right ventilation system.
We've always wanted new buildings. So we're going to use the pandemic as an excuse to get new buildings.
The funny thing, you know, I saw this and I thought, well, that's funny, Randy. I wonder why it is that the states that are fully open with public schools have seen no higher COVID. If the key is better airflow, how come the states with the exact same airflow as before that have fully open schools
are
seeing no additional COVID?
Yep.
Yes, they're seeing no additional COVID because of those schools being open. So that's odd because they've got the same ventilation systems. They haven't had the $100 billion in federal facilities money yet. That's weird. And yet, to Randy, that's the key to reopening.
Gotta love Randy Weingarten. Something else that I thought was interesting study that I've probably tweeted this headline six times now over the past year. And every time I do it, people respond by saying, well, no, duh. Why did you need a study to do this? So yet another study finding, and this has been found five other times, school reopenings are linked to union influence and political partisanship, but not COVID-19 hospitalization rates. This study, I just saw the article about it last week at Brookings Institution, but it's Brad Mariano at the University of, I think this is North Las Vegas. The quote from the study says exactly, quote, we find that pandemic severity as measured by the county COVID-19 hospitalization rate had no relationship with the probability of in-person reopening. They also went on to say, these findings match a growing body of literature that suggests local school reopening decisions are more about interest group influence and politics instead of pandemic spread. They went on to cite this guy, Corey DeAngelis, and his co-author, Christos Makridis, and a few other studies as well. And I continued in the thread to cite all six studies that have found this, that unions influence reopening and not so much, and so do politics in the area, but not so much the COVID risk in the area.
Yeah.
And here's all of the citations.
Yeah, I mean, we all kind of know that now, don't we? I think you were early to this revelation, but we all sensed it anyway. I mean, I think there was a weird politics with COVID from the beginning. I mean, I first noticed it when I saw Black Lives Matter demonstrations and the mainstream media was not talking about COVID. I was like, wait a minute. We were just been told how dangerous it is for people to gather. We've just been told churches can't gather. We've been told that, the Trump campaign meetings were verging on, you know, murderous because everyone's going to get sick and die. And just just routinely and viciously criticized for the danger of COVID from these outdoor meetings. You suddenly see the BLM protests. Suddenly the media goes silent, cricket sounds on the COVID transmission. And I think that's when I started to think, wow, like, wow, that's an interesting political take on what ought to be a purely epidemiological matter. So a lot of us sensed it, and you proved it, and now more people have.
Yeah, and every single time I share this, people are just like, you really needed a study to do that. But, you know, with ideological opponents, they're not just going to take your theory for it. You got to show them with data, even if it's something that seems pretty obvious that, look, the teacher unions are fighting for this, and if they're stronger, they're more likely to get their way, and that, you know, it doesn't really matter what the COVID risk in the area is. They're still going to push for the same thing. I think that... Yeah, you just have to show support your theory with the data as well. Now we have six studies, all six studies on the topic, all find different research teams, slightly different methods and analytic techniques and data sets in some cases, all finding the same relationships, different measures of union power. Different measures of COVID risk in the area, different measures of political partisanship.
Before we go, Corey, spin this forward for our listeners and viewers a little bit. So what do we have now? If you stand back to 30,000 feet, you say, oh, you have all these states with new school choice programs, but you also have enormous funds, sums of money arriving at traditional public schools from federal sources, unless you're in California, then it's federal and state. Enormous sums of money. What is this going to look like in 1 or 2 or 3 years? I mean, are we going to have these immensely wealthy public schools that spend money lavishly on everything, but then we'll also have more people leaving for a fraction of the expense to private schools?
Yeah, I mean, it's probably going to be a little bit of both. It's hard to tell, right? We don't know how long the federal government's going to keep this up with pouring more and more money into the system. But... yeah, I mean, that's what I would imagine, that the public schools are going to be more well-funded than they already are. Just looking at all these dang stimulus packages that are being passed over and over again, not being spent initially, and it's taking them, they have more money than they know what to do with. But the good news is we do have school choice programs passing in a lot of states as well. Not every state, but we've seen a lot of action, especially in the past week, and it's still happening as we speak. So hopefully more children will have access to educational freedom as well.
Okay, thanks for watching Random Assignment and listening, everybody, to our podcast and live stream. Tell a friend and subscribe to the Great Choice Media weekly Friday email of our news wrap up of the week.
All right, have a good weekend. Dang, it's not the weekend yet, Bob. Have a good rest of your week, everybody. We'll see you next time on the Random Assignment podcast.